Save us! Her eyes are wide, incredulous. She can't believe she isn't being believed. If you choose to sacrifice one of you, then the world doesn't end. That's it. It's that simple. I can't tell you any other way. Fuck! Leonard says, easy? Adrian continues on ranting. No charts or graphs or PowerPoints or what a fucking puppet show! She cuts out and holds pleading hands out toward Eric. He feels all the eyes of the room on him, including Andrew's and Wen's. He says, there is no choice. We will never choose to sacrifice one of ourselves, no matter what, period. Look, I know this is hard to hear, but you three are suffering from some kind of shared delusion, and delusions are powerful things. Adrian says, oh, Christ, we're fucked. We're all fucked, and throws her hands up. Wen says from the couch, Leonard told me it's God making them do this. Her speaking for the first time that morning freezes all the adults in place, like they were playing a game of red light, green light. Andrew asks, when did he tell you that? In the middle of the night. I woke up and he was awake too. Andrew says, well, he's wrong. They are doing this. No one and nothing else but them. And I know Leonard likes to act like your friend, but if he really was, he'd let us all go. Andrew glowers at Leonard, who doesn't rebut. Wen doesn't say anything else. She opens and closes her legs under the blanket, flapping them like butterfly wings. God wouldn't do this. Less confident in the declarative than his words would indicate, Eric says it hurriedly, as one might when uttering a perceived truth about a future event, while simultaneously worrying about being a jinx. In the same mental breath, he silently prays to God that they be freed from this ordeal unharmed. If pressed, Eric would identify himself as Catholic. He once said to a co-worker that he was a cautious Catholic. He goes to church once or twice a month. Sometimes he attends Mass on Sundays. And sometimes, when he is feeling particularly stressed, he'll go early on a weekday before work. Although he often struggles with the message and the messenger, the rote prayers and songs memorized so long ago as to have their own elaborately decorated memory palaces, the waxy cardboard taste of the host, and even the smell of dust, candles, and incense, are a comfort, a balm. No Christmas Catholic, only attending church for the big holidays, is he, and he would stop going to church altogether before becoming one. In the weeks preceding Wen's adoption, Eric reluctantly agreed, although the avowed agnostic Andrew doesn't know how reluctantly, with Andrew, that they would not have Wen baptized and not force her to adhere to any religion. Wen would be able to choose a religion when she was older, and when the choice was hers alone. Eric knew that was the same as saying that Wen would be brought up without any religion at all. It nags at him on occasion, as he feels like he's keeping an important part of himself from Wen. But he hasn't once protested the family decision, nor has he secretly proselytized. A warm breeze flows into the cabin through the screen slider, which wobbles and vibrates on its track, bringing with it the stronger-by-the-minute garbage smell that isn't really garbage. Andrew catches Eric's eye and nods at him. Is he telling him he did a good job? Does he know something? Are Andrew's ropes even looser than his, and he's telling him to be ready? The sunlight flashes and Eric turns away, fearful of being exposed to the light again when he might not be ready. Adrian walks to Sabrina and asks, what are they going to do? Sabrina whispers something out of earshot. Adrian drops her head and covers her face with her hands. Leonard fills himself up with air. He says, sacrifices are required and will be made one way or another, whether we like it or... Andrew jolts and spasms like he is stung by a bee. He shouts, Jesus Christ! Holy shit! Spewing a mess of profanities. Eric asks, What? What happened? Are you okay? Is Andrew acting? Is this part of a plan to get one of them over to his chair so he can do... Do what? Andrew is wild-eyed and breathing deeply, like he's fighting off the urge to throw up. Oh, fucking hell. Eric, it was him. Fucking Redmond. It was him. It was him. I knew these guys were nothing but a fringe group of homophobic nutbags here to... Oh, shit. Eric, shit, shit. Leonard, Sabrina, and Adrian back away from Andrew and share confused what-now looks. Slow down, slow down. Talk to me. Eric, momentarily forgetting about the chair and the ropes, tries to stand and walk to Andrew. He full-body flexes against his restraints and rebounds heavily back into the chair, which sends a dagger of pain through the center of his head. The rope binding his hands is looser than it was minutes ago, with the bulk of the wound knot having slid lower down his wrists, almost to the tops of his palms. He's confident he can squirm his hands free, but he isn't sure how long it would take and how obvious the effort would be to his captors. Andrew shouts at the others, Redmond isn't his name. You assholes using fake names, too. Did God tell you to do that? Adrian still has her hands over her face. What the hell is he talking about? Sabrina says, No, none of us are using fake names. Same for you guys, right? Adrian and Leonard say, Yeah, and of course. She looks distrustful of Andrew, afraid of him and what he's saying. That dead guy out there, the one you killed, his name is Jeff O'Bannon. Jeff O'Bannon. Eric repeats the man's name out loud, and then says it many more times in his creaky head. It's a name he knows, or a name he should know, and should be able to put a face to, or summon a dossier of significance for. He's the guy who attacked me in the bar, Eric. It's him. Andrew. A hockey bar by name, the penalty box was a hard-drinking dive, eschewing the ironic hipster faux charm that might now be associated with the term dive bar. On the corner of Causeway Street, across from North Station and the Boston Garden, the bar was on the first floor of a brick and cement, two-story rectangular shoebox of no recognizable architectural style beyond industrial. It had one square front window next to a cave-like entrance chiseled out of the brick, above which perched a yellow sign with thick black letters. It was generally patronized by mean drunks, people spending their last dollars or loose change or amateur hour assholes fluttering in pre- and post-Bruins and Celtics games. In the late 1990s, the tiny room above the penalty box, called the Upstairs Lounge, was a local music hotspot, and used to host what were called pill dance parties every Friday night. 80 or so people would jam into the dark and grimy room with a DJ playing Britpop. Pre-Eric, Andrew and a small group of friends attended the dances religiously for an almost 5-year run, including after they moved the pill dances from the Upstairs Lounge to a new venue in Alston. In November of 2005, Andrew and his friend Richie decided to go to the penalty box, the Upstairs Lounge having been long shuttered up, after ditching a Celtics game early for a glass or two of nostalgia. The bar was half full, with the green shirts of other Celtics game attendees, who had given up on the home team as they were down by 25 points early in the fourth quarter. Andrew had on a 20-year-old Robert Parrish tank top that was too small for him over a white long-sleeve t-shirt. Richie had a new Paul Pierce jersey on, even though he spent most of the game complaining about the player's shot selection and perceived lack of foot speed. In the intervening years, Andrew has curated a carefully pieced-together timeline of non-events prior to his attack. He and Richie were in the penalty box for less than 10 minutes. Andrew made a beeline for the bar upon entering and ordered 2 Sam Adams drafts. He doesn't remember seeing Jeff O'Bannon or his 2 friends sitting at the bar, which was where they were, according to the police report and testimony. Andrew carried the two beers over to Richie, who was near the entrance and talking to a middle-aged woman wearing a Bruins hoodie and jeans. Tall and rail thin, she was loudly drunk, and when she wasn't wiping greasy hair out of her face, her hummingbird hands were all over Richie's arms, shoulders, and back. And Richie couldn't have been more amused or pleased. Andrew doesn't remember her name. He gave Richie a beer, and they clinked their plastic cups. The woman told Richie he looked like Ricardo Montalban when he didn't look anything like him. She told Richie that Andrew was cute, but not as cute as he was. She laughed at her own joke, but there was a lag between, so he couldn't be sure why she was laughing. Andrew pretended to be offended at his second-class cuteness status. She asked Richie to dance, even though there wasn't any music playing, only the TV audio of Mike Gorman and Tommy Heinsohn calling the blowout game in muted, eulogistic tones. Andrew egged Richie on, telling him to go ahead and dance. Richie said things like, "I don't know. My quads are sore from my run this morning. Maybe. I have an inner ear problem, and I get dizzy if I spin around. I'm thinking about it. I'm missing the baby toe on my left foot, so I always list to the right. Sounds like fun, but..." She interjected with, "Oh, yes?" and more pleas for a dance. And now a beer, as her demands increased with the extended negotiating. Andrew thought she was pleased to simply have this conversation continue. Richie wasn't flustered in the least, like Andrew would have been, and started to ask her questions. "So where are you from? Come here often? Will the Celtics ever be good again?" Richie clearly enjoyed building the suspense of will he or won't he. Then Andrew remembers Richie asking, "What was the name of the last guy you danced with in here?" She smiled and waved a hand in the general direction of the opposite side of the room, like her previous dance partner was still there, and she said, "That fucking guy. His name was Milton." Andrew interjected, "Like the city?" "Yeah, he was no fun. Wouldn't let me feel him up." The three of them shared a big laugh. And then O'Bannon was behind Andrew over his left shoulder, and he said, "Faggot." And it wasn't a wild, out-of-control shout, and it wasn't slurred or sloppy. It was clear, concise, and dismissive, a one-word statement of argument and justification. Andrew turned to his left, toward the speaker, whose face he would not see in person until the two of them were in the same courtroom. As he turned, O'Bannon smashed a beer bottle on his head, the impact and follow-through cutting a gash that needed almost 30 stitches to close. Andrew remembers hearing the smash of glass, but there was no pain, and instead, a flash of cold on his head and neck, and then he was looking at the floor, which began getting closer very quickly. He remembers lying face down, with his eyes closed and people shouting. He doesn't remember getting into the ambulance, but he remembers insisting upon sitting up during the ride. He remembers the inexplicable feeling of shame upon seeing Eric for the first time at the hospital, when Eric said, "Oh my God, what happened to you?" Andrew whispered, "I don't know," and stopped. So he wouldn't say, "I don't know what I did." O'Bannon later pled guilty and told the court he was drunk and not thinking clearly, and that Andrew had accidentally spilled a beer on one of his friends, which was patently false. And they then were looking for a fight, and his friends egged him on, and he said repeatedly that that wasn't him, wasn't who he was. Andrew thought about the attack before every boxing lesson and workout, before each trip to the shooting range. For the first couple of years post-attack, when he couldn't sleep, he internet-searched his attacker's name, and he'd spend hours digging into the digital lives of other people named Jeff O'Bannon. After exhausting the information on his O'Bannon, and that's how he thought of the man, as belonging to him like a disease might, Andrew read about an O'Bannon who lived in Los Angeles, and worked in the art department for major Hollywood movies. And there was the one who was a middle school social science teacher in New Mexico and hosted a Looney Tunes viewing party for his students the first Friday of every month. Andrew spent one night poring through the 1940 government census and finding a 25-year-old Jeff O'Bannon, who had a wife, three kids, and his mother living in their Mississippi home. Later that night, Eric woke to find Andrew asleep in the desk chair, and he gently led him back to bed. Andrew has long since quit those internet searches, and he doesn't look over his shoulder in public places as frequently and as urgently as he once did, though the hypervigilance will never go away completely. In unguarded moments, he'll still pick and worry at why he was attacked. Well, he knows why. The hate-filled why was made painfully clear. But why did O'Bannon choose Andrew? How did O'Bannon know Andrew was gay and by proxy that Richie was not? If Richie had been standing with his back to the bar, would he have been the one who was attacked? Had O'Bannon simply made a terrible lucky guess? O'Bannon maintained in court his faggot wasn't why he attacked Andrew, and it didn't mean he thought Andrew was gay. It was a word he and his buddies used all the time, and it didn't mean anything to them, and the slur didn't and wasn't supposed to mean what it actually meant. Had O'Bannon seen Andrew outside, or even inside the Boston Garden, and then followed him to the bar, his dumb, ravenous hate fueled by Andrew's visage, the way he talked, the way he walked, or smiled, or laughed, or shook his head, or blinked his eyes? Did O'Bannon first see Andrew when he walked to the bar and ordered the beers? Did he look at Andrew and instantly see whatever it was he saw? Was Andrew like a bright orange flame to O'Bannon, burning only to invite his violence? Did O'Bannon patiently observe and deliberate and plan and have doubts that he overcame with a grunt and a swing of a glass bottle? As galling as Andrew's being somehow read and then classified by that fucking loser as an other, a thing, was that Andrew, at least for one night, was then marked as a victim. Andrew says, "It's him. He buzzed his head. He's older and more than 50 pounds heavier, and that bloated up his face and everything, so I didn't see it right away, but Christ, it's him. Redmond is Jeff O'Bannon. You know who I'm talking about, right?" "Yes, of course, yes." Eric furrows his brow, and Andrew can't tell if Eric remembers O'Bannon and or recognizes Redmond is the same guy. Okay, you might be right." "Might be? I mean, I don't see it, but how can you not see it?" "But if you say it's him, then it's him. I believe you." Eric won't meet Andrew's eyes. Andrew sighs. "Damn it. I'm telling you, it's him. I would know, Eric." "Yes, yes, of course you would." Adrian says, "Hey, guys, we don't have time for this. We need you to make the choice." Her statements are questions. "Wait, hold on," Sabrina says, and her weapon wilts in her hands. "What are you saying Redmond did?" Andrew says, "Going on 13 years ago, I was in a Boston bar with a friend and your guy, totally unprovoked, snuck up behind me, called me a faggot, and smashed a bottle over my head, knocking me out and cutting me open." Andrew spies Wen watching him. Her empty expression breaks open as she flinches and blinks hard twice. Adrian says, "Oh, shit." Sabrina exhales sharply, distending her cheeks. Adrian says, "Hey, you're not, you know, making that up to get us to..." She stops talking as though the question mark is worth 1,000 more words. He considers telling them to take a good look at his scar that runs from the base of his skull down the back of his neck, but he doesn't want to risk their closer inspection now that his hands are finally loose enough within the ropes to wriggle free. He spent his waking hours in the dark last night, flexing and unflexing his fingers, twisting and bending his wrists. It's no longer a question of if he can free his hands. but when should he? Andrew says, I'm not lying or making any of this up, and Redmond is the guy who attacked me. I've never been more sure of anything in my life. How about one of you go out to the deck and find his wallet, his license, and read his name? It'll be Jeff O'Bannon. Sabrina says, I'm not calling you a liar, Andrew. I believe you're not making up the getting assaulted. He does have that nasty-ass scar on the back of his neck, Adrian says, pointing at Andrew, and backs away from him to stand between the others. Leonard's shoulders are slumped. Some unseen great weight is pushing him down. Andrew, you told Wen your scar was from getting hit with a baseball bat when you were a kid. Huh? Wait, how? Andrew sputters and looks at Wen. She doesn't look back, as immobile and blank-faced as a mannequin. He doesn't know what to say to her, other than he's sorry. He's sorry for everything in the world. Leonard says, Wen told me. So which one of you is telling the truth? Both of us. I'm telling you what happened, and what she told you is what I told her, Andrew says to Wen. I didn't want you to know that a terrible, awful person did this to me. I didn't want you to know there were those kinds of people out there. Andrew makes sure to dramatically glare at each of the three others before continuing. Not yet, anyway. He'd planned on telling her the truth about his scar when she was older, when she could understand. He'd irrationally hoped he could somehow put off indefinitely the future day on which she would recognize cruelty, ignorance, and injustice were the struts and pillars of the social order, as unavoidable and inevitable as the weather. Leonard says, I get it, and I don't blame you at all. And listen, I believe you're not making it up, but isn't it possible that Redmond only resembles? No, it's him, I guarantee it. Andrew can see that ratty, skinny weasel he watched squirm in the courtroom, grow older and bulk up before his eyes, transforming into the troll-like Redmond. There is no doubt he will not allow for it. Andrew closes his hands into fists, clenching some of the rope, hopefully giving the appearance his restraints are still tight and secure should one of them walk behind him. Adrian says in a lowered voice, like she's trying it out. I guess Redmond got his, then. Sabrina groans and goes chest to chest with Leonard. Fuck. Fuck. Jesus, Leonard, did you know this? Any of this about Redmond? What? No, no, of course not. And I'm not calling Andrew a liar, but maybe it's not. What do you know about him? I know as much as you do. I know him as well as I know you two, and I thought, we really don't have time for this. He pauses, and Sabrina doesn't move, doesn't release him. I thought, like you thought, he was rough around the edges and stuff, but was basically a good guy. Seriously? It was pretty obvious he wasn't. At best, he was an obnoxious dick, Adrian says. Sabrina says, you and him were there on the message board before I found it, before Adrian got there. A message board? Andrew shouts, and he means it to sound like an aha accusation or vindication. A fucking online message board. Maybe the others aren't religious lunatics, and maybe they are, but they are certainly regular, non-denominational lunatics with, as Eric had phrased earlier, a shared delusion. Andrew recalls reading about a uniquely 21st century mental health crisis, with a growing population of people suffering from clinically paranoid psychotic delusions, deciding to ignore professional help and cut themselves off from friends and family. These people are instead seeking emotional support online, where they have found hundreds, even thousands of like-minded people, many of whom refer to themselves as targeted individuals, or TIs, on social media, and yes, on message boards. Online, the delusion sufferer is not told what she is experiencing is a chemical lie, or the result of misfiring synapses, and she is not accused of being crazy. The online groups reinforce and validate the delusions because the same thing is happening to them. There was a man who recently shot and killed 3 people on an army base in Louisiana. He had been part of a large online group of TIs who blogged and posted YouTube videos explaining how a shadow government was stalking them and using mind control weapons in an attempt to destroy their lives. Andrew wonders if proving to the 3 intruders that Redmond isn't who they thought he might be, that he isn't like them, isn't one of them, them being some quasi-pious noble group of would-be humanity savers, would allow doubt to create cracks and fissures spidering through the group delusion. All 3 of them are clearly unnerved by the bar attack accusation, and Sabrina and Adrian appear to be openly struggling with what they've done, and whatever it is they are supposed to do next. Doubt is good, right? Or will it make them more desperate and dangerous, more likely to become violent and lash out in defense of their beliefs? Andrew loosens his fists and lets the rope out of his clenched fingers for a moment, double-checking that he will indeed be able to free his hands. Sabrina says, "Yes, a message board." Then to Leonard, "How long were you..." Leonard says, "I set it up, like one of my visions told me to, and Redmond was the first to get there, but he was there only like a few hours before you. We didn't talk about anything you couldn't read yourselves after you joined, and he never said anything outright hateful." "Did you and him talk on the phone or anything?" "No, never." Adrian says, "Redmond was the one who first said he had the vision of the name of the lake and the town." Leonard asks, "Maybe, okay, I guess so. But what are you saying? What are you implying?" Eric, who has been conspicuously silent, raises his voice to interrupt, and winces as he does so. "She's implying that your Redmond picked out this place purposefully." Andrew adds, "And he picked it out because Redmond knew we were going to be here, or, most importantly to him, that I was going to be here." Leonard says, "That's impossible. Even if... how could he find that out? It's not like that. We all had the visions. Sabrina, Adrian, me, we saw this cabin too. You saw it, didn't you? You both said you did." Sabrina and Adrian nod their heads affirmative, and then peel away from Leonard's orbit and away from each other, spreading into the room. Leonard says, "We saw the lake, this little red cabin. We saw where this place was." He pauses and points at the front door. "I saw the dirt road in the front of the cabin. I even saw the grain of the wood on the front door. It was like I'd known it my whole life, and I knew there would be a family here, a very special one. And the family would have to make the choice, would have to make a sacrifice to save us all." He ping-pongs between looking at Sabrina and Adrian. "Now don't let it get all turned around. I know, this sucks, all of it, and I'm sick to my stomach over it. But we'll all get past it because the suffering here is not eternal. It's a test. We were chosen and we're being tested, all of us. You too, Andrew, Eric, and Wen. And if we don't pass this most difficult and important of all tests, the world is going to end. And as far as Redmond goes, maybe..." He turns and holds a hand out to Andrew. "Maybe it's not him. You said yourself 13 years have passed, and he's, what, more than 50 pounds heavier?" "I know it's him. I'm not..." "I know, I know. And maybe it is him. I don't know if Redmond is his real name or not, and I don't mean to belittle what happened to you. But does it matter in terms of what we have to do here?" Sabrina goes red-faced and shouts, "Of course it matters! If I had known he'd done that to Andrew or to anyone, I wouldn't have..." She stops. Eric says, "You wouldn't have what?" "I was going to say that I wouldn't have come here. But it's not true, because I didn't choose to come here. This is not my choice. I already tried to ignore the visions and messages, and I tried to stay home, and I tried not to come out here, and it didn't work. The day before I was supposed to fly out, I didn't set my alarm or pack or do anything to get ready. I didn't even tell work I was going to be out. And then it was the next morning, and there I was, sitting in a cab halfway to LAX. Adrian says, "Same," and laughs an odd little laugh, high-pitched and chittering. "Isn't this a fucking pickle?" Eric says, "You don't want to be here, so let us go. You don't have to do this anymore. You know you don't." Sabrina lifts her weapon, recalibrating, reconsidering. It rises like a buoy in an ocean swell. "Sabrina," Leonard says, "I know you are not who O'Bannon was, regardless if Redmond is the same guy. And Adrian is not O'Bannon, and I am not O'Bannon. We were called to be here as a force of good. I know this to be true. I feel it in my cells. I think you do too. I said it before. We are not here with hate or judgment in our hearts. We are here with love for everyone, for all humankind. We're willing to sacrifice our own lives in the hope that we might save everyone else." Eric says, "No," repeatedly, and then, "Just let us go. Please, let us go." Andrew stares hard at Eric, and Eric stares back. Can Andrew somehow communicate that the ropes are loose around his wrists with a look? Leonard says, "I only said it doesn't matter if Redmond was Andrew's attacker, because what any of us might have done in the past will not change this moment or what happens next. The past, all of our pasts, will be wiped away. What matters is we're here now and why we're here. What matters is passing this test. We were chosen, all of us, for a reason. That is what matters, and I'm not going to question that. We can't." Eric says, "No, you should be questioning it. That's exactly what you should be doing." Andrew says, "Don't you recognize how wrong this is? Look at us, tied up here. Really look at us. Is this right or normal? Is this what young nurses, chefs, and guys right out of college do on the weekends? How about you go have a look at the guy you mashed to a pulp out on the deck? Tell me that's not wrong." He regrets mentioning their killing Redmond O'Bannon, as though not speaking of the act prevents them from more killing. Leonard says, "If you and Eric can find a way to make the right choice, sacrifice one of yourselves, then the world will live, and that means Wen will live too. Don't you want her to..." Eric says, "Enough. That's enough. Stop talking. I can't. Just stop." The room goes quiet, as though the silence is planned, allotted. Outside the cabin, unseen birds chirp and sing their evolutionary songs as the sun creeps higher in the blue morning sky that keeps watch over the lake and its still, dark, and cold water. Andrew knows he must make a move to escape from the chairs soon, but with hands that are stiff and numb, he doesn't know if he'll be able to untie his legs before the others descend upon him. Sabrina coughs. "I think we're running out of time."
"It's me running out of fucking time."
Adrian bends forward, and each percussive sob is leaden with grief, a hidden scream.
"We have to do something to get them to choose, and choose now."
Leonard says, "I know, we're trying."
"Try more. Try fucking harder. Threaten to hurt one of them. Bust a knee, take off a finger, something. Not seriously hurt them, but enough to know this is serious."
"Adrian." Sabrina steps between her and Andrew and Eric. Andrew's sour and curdling stomach plummets through the floor to the center of the shrinking earth
as his traitorous head fills with images of them cutting off Eric's fingers or Wen's, one by one. He looks at Wen, and she remains huddled on the couch, half covered by a blanket. She is shut down. Perhaps she's in shock.
It'll be the only way!
Adrian is full throat yelling. We have to get this shit done. They'll just wait us out until all of us die if we don't. Leonard strides forward, a rolling boulder filling a narrowing cave.
We can't let you hurt them. You know we can't. It's not allowed.
Fucking easy for you to say. You're not next, are you? I don't want my body stuffed under a blanket and stacked next to that piece of shit out there. I don't want to die.
Sabrina crouches and calmly says, They'll believe us. They will.
No, they don't, and they won't, not ever.
Shh, they will. You'll see, they will.
Adrian's words come in clipped bursts between hitching inhales.
The worst part is, I knew I was dead as soon as I started seeing all this shit. I knew I was dead already.
Adrian is still bent over and crying. Sabrina crouches and whispers and cajoles. Leonard checks his watch, and while he utters vague reassurances to them, he has the resigned, desperate, and committed look of a person who knows everything is going poorly and will continue to go poorly, no matter what. Adrian straightens up, pushes Sabrina and Leonard away, and wipes the tears off her cheeks violently.
Okay, I'm okay. I lost it, but I'm good.
She takes two steps toward Eric and Andrew.
Hey, so you know I'm dead meat.
Leonard says, Adrian, you can't. She turns on Leonard and snarls at him.
Shut your fucking mouth. It's my turn. It's up to me, and I'm gonna do it my way. All right? Is that all right?
She doesn't give Leonard or Sabrina a chance to respond.
So what's it gonna be? Another calamity like the earthquakes and tsunamis and hundreds, thousands more people dying, this time by plague? That'll be fun, yeah? Plus the bonus of the unpleasant sight of little old me getting bashed like a piñata. Or, will you stop it all from happening and sacrifice one of yourselves?
She pulls a white mesh mask out of a back pocket. It looks exactly like the one Redmond pulled over his own head. Unhinged and wild-eyed, she shakes and dangles the mask in front of Andrew and Eric.
Come on, what's it gonna be? You want me to put it on first?
She stuffs her right fist inside and holds it like a puppet that's going to say something obnoxious, scandalous. Something only a puppet would be allowed to say.
There you go.
You pick. One of you sacrifices yourself, or all kinds of other people die. She makes crashing noises and pantomimes striking the mask-covered fist. Andrew shakes his head and groans, because he thinks he has waited too long to free his hands. So does he wait even longer? Wait them out, like Adrian intimated? Are they really going to kill Adrian like they killed O'Bannon? Are they that committed to their obviously revelations-inspired rituals? He still doesn't know why they are killing themselves, and at some point, they would have to stop killing each other and turn on Eric or Andrew or Wen, wouldn't they?
Eric says, Hold on. Wait, wait, wait.
He's loud enough that Adrian slows her cricket's bounce from her heels to her toes. She takes the mask off her hand and hides it behind her back, like no one was supposed to see it. He says,
Let's just keep talking, okay? Adrian, tell us about the restaurants you worked at. I want to hear about them.
Sabrina says, Guys, this is it. You have to choose.
There's time. There's time. Come on, let's talk a little while longer, okay?
Eric's deep, smooth voice has the faintest waver. He is obviously stalling with how he's trying to engage the others into talking about themselves and their old lives. They aren't answering him, and they close in toward one another, clustering like molecules. Andrew imagines everyone in the cabin,
is visualizing the same blow-by-blow transgression of violence to come, an act of collective foretelling or summoning. The room feels like it did in the moments before the others killed O'Bannon. Andrew experiences an animal foreboding and an instinctual compulsion to flee from the inevitability, as well as an unsettling, vertiginous itch to become a willing participant. If the others swing their weapons again, even if only against Adrian, he will raise his hands and fight. Andrew says,
"Wen, you should come be with one of us now, I think."
Wen is on the couch, not looking at anyone or anything. Leonard turns and says to her,
"You can stay there, too. You can cover your eyes with your blanket. You'll be okay."
Andrew shouts, "Right, it'll all be fine. After a little bludgeoning, maybe you'll let her go outside and play with the grasshoppers."
Adrian says, "Our last chance, fellas. What'll it?"
Wen erupts into high-pitched screams of the kind she's only ever unleashed when suffering great, incomprehensible pain. "The grasshoppers! The grasshoppers! The grasshoppers!" She kicks away the blanket and spasms off the couch. She stands and trembles with her arms held out, begging for someone to hold her, to take her. After the initial torrent, she is crying so hard no sound comes out. Silent open mouth, wet cheeks, beseeching eyes. She remains soundless long enough for Andrew to worry she stopped breathing as he unconsciously holds his own breath. Then, finally, a guttural, gasping inrush of air, and she resumes screaming.
"They're in the jar. I left them in the sun. They're going to die. They're all going to be dead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. I forgot. Daddy, I forgot. I forgot."
She runs unsteadily to Eric and scrambles into his lap. Everyone says her name, and there's a group murmur asking her to slow down and tell them what's wrong. The others form a semicircle around Wen and Eric, but none of them reach out for her, as though she's not safe to touch. Wen grabs fistfuls of Eric's t-shirt and yells into his face,
"I left it on the grass and ran inside because I was scared. The jar is still out there. You have to let me go get it. I have to check. Let them out if they're still alive. Maybe they're still alive. Let me go get them. Please, please, please."
Leonard bends and leans forward, trying to get in her sight line.
"Wen? Wen, honey? It's okay. I let them out. I did. After you ran inside, I let them out of the jar. They all hopped away. They're all happy."
"Daddy, he's lying. He's a liar. They're still there. There are 7 in the jar. I wrote down their names. We have to let them out. I don't want them to die. I don't want them to be dead. Please, let's go now. Please, Daddy."
Wen dissolves in teary pleases and daddies and pounds on Eric's chest, her fists demanding, "Why isn't he up and going outside with her already?" Eric says,
"Okay, okay," and wiggles and shifts his seated position, struggling to keep her balanced on his lap.
And then his arms hesitantly appear from behind the chair, unfurling like great, unused wings. The skin of his hands and wrists is red, excoriated and raw. He wraps his arms around her quivering form, and he kisses the top of her head, and is crying now himself. The others do a group double-take at Eric's arms releasing from the ropes and releasing so casually. Sabrina and Leonard lay their weapons on the floor and share quizzical looks. Adrian covers her face and whisper yells,
"We can't even tie a fucking knot right. Should have brought duct tape like Redmond said."
Sabrina places a hand on Eric's shoulder, like a friend might in a vulnerable moment. Leonard pokes and taps Eric's other shoulder and asks him, politely, to let his daughter go. Adrian bounces between the two, suggesting Leonard pull his arms apart and Sabrina grab Wen. Eric shouts at the others to leave them alone, to go away, to give them a minute more. With the others frantic and occupied, The time for Andrew's escape has to be now. He doesn't hesitate. He calmly shrugs and lifts his right shoulder. A movement as innocuous and ordinary as a breath expanding within his chest. As his shoulder rises, he slides his right hand up. There's a pull, pinch, and burn on his palm and at the base of his thumb. And then his right hand is free. The rest of the binding sloughs off his left hand and wrist. The thud of rope hitting the floor is louder than he anticipated, but the others don't react to it. Andrew brings his arms around to his front, careful not to stretch them out wide, confining them to the width of the chair and his torso. He rests his hands and forearms on his thighs momentarily and flexes his swollen, chafed fingers and knuckles. His hands are unable to fully close into fists. Andrew bends and reaches toward his feet and ankles, making no sudden movements, nothing to catch the corners of eyes, nothing to alert the others to his Houdini act. He is composed and considerate as he goes about the serious business of untying the leg ropes. The knots behind his calves are thick and obvious, and they give away their secrets to his battered fingers. Andrew does not look up and to his left until after the knots are solved. The others are still struggling with Eric. His arms remain stubbornly locked around Wen. Not even Leonard is going to be able to simply pull his arms apart. Sabrina begs Eric to let go. Adrian has both hands on one of Eric's wrists and forearms, yanking and trying to peel an arm open. Leonard argues with Adrian, telling her to calm down and to let go of Eric's arm as he tries to snake his hands between Wen and Eric. Wen yells, "Go away!" and windmills her arms, striking out at Leonard. As Andrew gives in to haste and hurry while unwinding the never-ending loops of rope from his legs, he visualizes two potential paths to the SUV and the gun in the trunk compartment. The shortest path would be through the front door, but he'd have to wade through the others and take time to unlock the door. But if he could get outside, he'd be unimpeded to the SUV. The path of least resistance out of the cabin would be through the deck slider, but it's a much longer run down those wooden stairs around the cabin into the driveway. One or more of the others would most certainly be out the front door and to the SUV before he could get there. Maybe if he is stealthy enough, he can sneak out onto the deck without the others seeing. Andrew stands on the creaky, rusty legs of the Tin Man and readies for a dash through the back slider. Adrian points and yells, "Fuck you!" at Leonard. She shuffles into the center of the room and stands directly in front of Andrew. They share a surprised, head-tilted look. Adrian yells, "Hey!" and lunges at him. Andrew slide-steps and knocks his chair onto its side, then kicks it into Adrian's legs. She stumbles and plunges forward, her hands pressing on the inverted chair back to keep from falling to the floor. Sabrina grabs Andrew's left arm, and he spins to face her with his painful, crumpled paper fists raised. She unexpectedly grunts, winces, and collapses onto her knees. Eric is behind her, still sitting and with one arm around Wen, and he gives Sabrina another backhanded kidney punch. She crawls away from Eric's reach, a hand pressed against her lower back. Eric switches the arm with which he holds Wen and throws left jabs at Leonard's midsection. Leonard clumsily fends off the blows from Eric's pistoning arm with open hands. One punch catches him in the groin, and he staggers back into one of the bedroom doorways. Eric shouts, "Andrew, take Wen and go. Take her." Leonard recovers and approaches Eric from his left. Adrian has already discarded the chair in her legs obstacle, but instead of going after Andrew, she renews her grappling with Eric. Eric alternates throwing quick punches at Adrian and Leonard while shielding Wen. Adrian yells, "Hit him, Leonard! Hit him in the head!" Leonard says, "We don't want to hurt you," and attempts to snare Eric's left arm when it lashes out. Sabrina is upright now, too, has her weapon, and steps toward Andrew. Andrew can't fight off all three at once, not without his gun. He lunges for the front door, pulls the latch bolt to the right, turns the knob and flings the door open wide all in one motion. With a rush of warm air and sunlight, the door opens too wildly, and the momentum of the pendulous swing almost sends him tumbling back into the cabin. He maintains his grip on the doorknob, leans all his weight forward, and stumbles outside, pulling the door shut behind him. His slow and heavy feet cannot catch up with his forward lean, and he pitches down the small set of stairs, landing chest and face first on the grass. His breaths are painful and short, air squeezing out of the pinched end of a balloon. He blinks away the shock and unsteadily restacks himself onto shaky legs. Once upright, he starts the forward-moving engine again. The cabin's front door opens behind him. Sabrina yells, "Andrew, stop! Come back!" Andrew doesn't stop, and he doesn't look to see if anyone else is with her. The SUV is 10 to 15 yards away. The driver's side front and rear tires are flat, and the side walls have been slashed. He assumes the other tires have been slashed as well. That car isn't going anywhere. His right hand goes into his shorts pocket in search of the familiar lump of his car keys. They're not there. He remembers that he gave Eric the keys yesterday when the others were breaking into the cabin. If the car doors are locked, he won't be able to get to the gun, and he doesn't know what he will do, what he can do. Andrew races onto the gravel driveway, the loose stones part and grind under his feet, spewing clouds of dirt. The stomped-on gravel crunch is too loud, all-encompassing, like a mob is sprinting across the driveway. But he won't look back, can't look back. Maybe Sabrina has caught up to him. Maybe she isn't alone. He's almost to the passenger side door that he'll open because it has to open. Not opening is not an option. And then he'll jump inside the car and lock the doors, which will give him time to crawl into the back seat and to the trunk. Something sharp and heavy crashes into the outside of his right knee, which buckles and sings with jagged, white-hot agony. Andrew falls and bounces off the car door, absorbing most of the collision with his forearms and hands, before landing on his screaming knee. He flips over into a sitting position with his back against the car and faces Sabrina. Sabrina stands over him and says, "You can't leave them. You can't leave us. We all need you. Come back inside. I'll help you." In an oddly detached, unearthly monotone, she lifts her weapon, raising the tapered edge of the curled-over and pointed shovel blade, appearing to reload for another swing, despite her promise of help. Andrew scoops up a fistful of gravel and dirt, and he underhand throws it into her face. With her eyes closed and head turned to the side, he scrambles up onto his left knee and punches her in the stomach. An almost comical oof plumes out of Sabrina, and she folds in half. He tries to snatch the weapon away, but she falls backward, landing on her butt, one hand over her midsection, the other on the weapon, holding it so as to ward off more blows. Andrew pivots, and he flips up the car door handle. He grunts in triumph as it's not locked, and the door clicks open. He slithers inside the SUV, coiling himself into the passenger seat, shutting and locking the door behind him. The pain in his right knee has dulled some, but is now focused on the inner side, not where the weapon contacted him. Already swollen to twice its normal size, the knee is wobbly and as loose as a door hinge when he puts weight on it. Sabrina rocks herself up into a standing position. She's hunched over, still holding her midsection and gasping for air. She shambles to the SUV, and in a matter of moments, she will smash windows with that goddamn nightmare stick. Andrew shimmies between the front bucket seats and worms over the center console into the back, dragging his right leg behind instead of relying on it to propel him. His right foot snags between the console and the passenger seat, and while pulling it free doesn't exactly hurt, his stomach flips at how unstable and putty-like his knee is. Sabrina's shovel blade clangs off the rear passenger window. The glass doesn't break, but there's a gouge and crack dousing a haphazard path to the window frame. Hand over hand, Andrew scrabbles over the middle of the back seat, where there is no headrest. It's still a tight, awkward squeeze to pull his torso over the seat back so that he can hang into the trunk area. The side panel storage is to his right. He paws at two black plastic knobs, turns them clockwise to 6 o'clock, and pulls away the plastic hatch. The window to his left disintegrates, and jagged little glass cubes sting his bare lower legs, and a handful ricochet off the rear windshield and roll around in the trunk. Andrew spasms, ducks his head between his shoulders and behind raised arms. With the window gone, Sabrina's rough and greedy gasps for air suffuse into the car. Andrew mule kicks his left leg behind him. He yells, and his body tenses up for another strike from Sabrina, anticipating the pain to come. Within the opened side panel is his handgun safe. Less than a year old and not much bigger than an 800-page hardcover book. It's a The Future Is Now aluminum alloy silver gadget with a sleek, edgeless design. Eric joked that it looked like a panini maker and asked if it could make him a tuna melt. The newest, lightest model he could find at the time of purchase, it's biometric, opening after the sensor on the top reads the owner's palm or thumbprint. Andrew extracts the gun box out of the interior darkness of the side panel, dumps it onto the trunk floor, and waves his palm over the sensor. The cover opens on its mini hydraulic arms. Inside, splayed on the black neoprene lining, are his snub-nosed .38 special, loose bullets, and a small cardboard ammunition box, the top flap tattered and open, which must have happened during transport, or as the unit was roughly jostled from the storage panel. Sabrina has the car door open. "Leave whatever it is you're going after. Get out of the car and come back inside. I don't want to hurt you." Can she see the gun box? Or the gun? Probably not from where she is standing, and with his body likely blocking her view of the trunk. Andrew snatches the gun with his right hand. It's compact, but solid, fitting purposefully into the folds of palm and fingers, which have lost some of their stiffness from the fight with O'Bannon and a day of disuse. With one hand, he presses a thumb piece forward and pushes down on the cylinder until it swings open to the left. He shakily begins loading bullets into the five chambers. Sabrina jabs him in the left side, the rusty tip of metal digging under his ribs. Andrew yelps, twitches, and tries to curl away from the repurposed spade, but he's bottled in by the adjacent rear headrest. He knocks the gun box over, spilling the contents. The bullets scatter and roll to all corners, madly eager for movement and to achieve their projectile apotheosis on their own. The jab from Sabrina hurts, but there isn't much oomph behind it, as maybe she doesn't have enough leverage given the constraints of the confined enclosing of the SUV interior. Or she's hesitant and isn't sure what to do to get him to come back inside the cabin and hasn't fully committed to stabbing him with a bizarre, customized weapon as the solution. Andrew yells as though he's in more pain than he is and kicks out behind him, connecting only with the back of the front passenger seat. He plucks one last stray, teasing bullet from the trunk floor and fills the fifth and final chamber. Sabrina says, "You have to come back inside. We don't have time for this," and jabs him again with the weapon, and with more force, the tip prodding painfully between his ribs. He closes the cylinder and pushes off the trunk floor with his left arm. With both arms outstretched over his head, he sinks back onto his haunches, like a dive into water reversed, pulling his chest over the seat back. He twists and sags against the other rear passenger door. Sabrina is crouched within the opposite doorframe. Her hands slid farther up the length of the wooden staff, a little eager, choking up on a bat. Andrew fires a wild, nominally aimed shot. The report